market for health insurance.
Well, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to present here. In this paper, I study retirees' decision to buy annuities, and I want to start with showing you this table. So this table is constructed from HRS AHEAD dataset, which is the biggest dataset collecting data on retirees and, in general, older population in the United States. And this table reports the percent of people who are older than 70 years old in this data set and who have any income from private annuity. So see here, around less than 8% of people have any income from private annuity. If we decompose this by quintiles of permanent income distribution, there is a very big variation. For example, in the bottom quintile, you see that less than 1% of people have any income from private annuity. For the highest quintile, almost 16% of people have income from private annuity. And of course, the question is this number big or small? And most of you in this room know very well that from the perspective of a standard life cycle model, these numbers are incredibly small. Because the standard life cycle model say that risk-averse people, when facing lifespan uncertainty, are really concerned about longevity risk. And so they really value annuities as an instrument that protects them against this longevity risk. And so this is a long-standing puzzle that was first pointed out with Professor Yari 45 years ago. And since then, there was a lot of attention devoted to this puzzle. And of course, there was a bunch of explanations suggested for why people do not buy as much annuities as we expect them to buy. So in particular, I will review, so today some speakers already talked about this explanation. I will just do a quick review. So first of all, bequest motives. Annuities cannot be bequested, so obviously people with a strong bequest motive should not be very enthusiastic about buying a lot of annuities. Second, retirees in the United States receive Social Security Defined Benefit Pension Plan income. And this income comes in annuitized form, so maybe people just already have enough annuities until they're not interested to buy additional annuities. Also, the price of annuities is based on your survival probability. But survival probability in general is not observable, so maybe the market just suffers from adverse selection and the annuities are just too expensive for most of the population. Also, we know that elderly population face high medical expense risk. And so maybe they're just more concerned about insuring their medical risk than about insuring their longevity risk. So these four explanations are what I call traditional explanations because they're discussed a lot in the literature. And though each one of them cannot fully account for the puzzle, but people believe that each one of them do contribute something. On top of that, I want to discuss another three explanations that I discussed much less in the literature. Some of them never mentioned, actually, even. So first is consumption minimum floor. So consumption minimum floor, or government mean tested transfer, provides support for people who do not have enough assets, including people who outlive their assets. So you can think about this consumption minimum floor being a public way of public longevity insurance. And it may crowd out private longevity insurance. Another consideration is that a considerable fraction of wealth of households who retire is housing wealth. And if there are some difficulties with annuitizing housing wealth, it will also decrease demand for annuities. Finally, usually when we talk about life cycle model and we model annuity demand, we allow people to buy any amount of annuity. They can buy $10 worth of annuity if they wish to. In reality, if you walk into the insurance company and ask them to sell you $10 worth of annuity, you will just get laughed at. Usually, insurance companies set some restriction, which I call minimum purchase requirement, on how much you have to invest in annuity in order for insurance company actually to sell the annuity to you. And so these are the seven explanations that I'm going to consider. And so what I'm going to do in this paper, I'm going to construct a model, a quantitative model, and I we'll try to understand how quantitatively important each of the seven other seven explanations. So which explanation is more important and which explanation is less important, quantitatively. And so to do this, I will construct a model of saving after retirement, and this model will nest all the seven explanations. And this is a partial equilibrium model. However, because it will nest all the seven explanations, including the adverse selection one, I will explicitly model the annuity market. So to understand how severe the problem is and which categories of population suffer the most from the adverse selection. So what I found. So first I found that out of the seven explanations, there is only one that doesn't help to explain the puzzle at all, which is medical expense uncertainty. All other six explanations, they do play a role in reducing annuity demand. However, quantitatively, the effect is different. So in particular, Social Security and defined benefit plans have a big effect. Actuarial unfairness or adverse selection have small effect as well as bequest motive. Consumption flow has a big effect, and minimum purchase requirement, especially when combined with the liquidity of housing wealth, have big effect. So now let me explain how I get this result. So the model that I have has two types of agents. First is the household, and second is the insurance company. For the household, so I consider a saving model of single retirees who have an option of invest in two assets. One is risk-free bond, and the other is annuities. They enjoy living a bequest. Some fraction of their wealth is exogenously prioritized through Social Security and defined benefit plans. And also they face medical expense uncertainty. And so households in this model are highly heterogeneous. Why? Well, remember the very first table that I showed you, that people are quite heterogeneous in terms of annuity demand. There is a big variation by quintiles in terms of how much annuities people actually have. And to incorporate this heterogeneity in annuity demand into the model, I have the following dimension of heterogeneity of my household. So first, households are heterogeneous by their initial wealth that they start retirement with. They're heterogeneous by pre-existing annuity income from Social Security and defined benefit plan. They're heterogeneous by life expectancy, by health, and by medical expense shock. So I will skip the formal slide, which is basically the standard consumption optimization problem subject to budget constraint. And so just a couple of words of how do I set up preferences. So for the consumption, it's a standard CRI utility function, and it's a discrete time model, by the way. So this is a standard CRI utility function with sigma risk aversion parameter. So just a couple of words of a bequest function. There was a lot of discussion today how to model the bequest. So this paper, basically, I put bequest as an altruistic bequest, and I put it as a luxury good. So basically what it means is that in this model, people have some willingness to sacrifice their today consumption in order to leave something for their kids, but this desire depends on how much wealth they have. So if I'm really poor, I don't really care about my kids much, but if I'm really rich, then probably I have a very strong bequest motive. And the extent to which bequest is a luxury good is controlled by this parameter of phi. So if phi is almost zero, that means everyone leaves bequest because not living a bequest gives you infinite disutility. If phi is very high, that means only once I reach some threshold of wealth would I care about any bequest. And eta here is just how strong my bequest motive is once it becomes operational. So another important part of this model, of course, health uncertainty. And in this, so here this, I've borrowed the framework from the paper of Gennardi, French, and Jones of 2010. Three important facts about this specification. First, health status. So health status can be either good or bad, and it evolves over time. So it's a random variable that follows the Markov process. For the health scores that people face, they are log normally distributed, and the stochastic part of medical cost is very persistent. Finally, another important part is what determines survival probability and average medical expenditures. They depend on three things. First, on age. Obviously, people who are older, they have lower survival probability and higher medical expenditures. Also, it depends on health. Obviously, people who are in bad health, they have lower survival probability and higher medical expenditures. Finally, and very importantly, is that both survival probability and mean of medical expenditures depends on income. So basically, the dependence goes this way. People who are richer, people with higher permanent income, they also expect to live longer. At the same time, they expect to have higher medical expenditures. So you will see how these factors interplay when forming annuity demand. So for the insurance companies, I assume that insurance companies act competitively, and I consider two scenarios. So under the first scenario, I assume that insurance companies observe all variables relevant to figure out your survival probability. So in this situation, you come to buy annuity, you get your individual price, which depends on your personal survival probability. I call this scenario full information scenario. Then the second scenario, which I call asymmetric information scenario, the insurance company are not allowed to see anything except age. That means that each age pays only one annuity price, regardless what the actual survival probability is. And that scenario, of course, that will give rise to adverse selection. So let me skip the formal description of the insurer's problem and just go to calibration. So the way I calibrate the model, the sigma risk aversion parameter was set to 4, and discount factor, the household discount future is beta is set to 0.97. Interest rate on the risk-free bond is set to 2%. For the consumption floor, so basically I will show you what happens when once I change that, but for the baseline experiments, I set it to the very low value, one of the lowest available in the literature right now, and this comes from the structural estimate of Dinard, French, and Jones paper, and it's equal to 2,600-something. So for the household in my model, they start their life at age 70, and they die for sure at age 100. Before that, they can die with some conditional probability, but I assume that household can buy annuity every period until they reach age 88. And I restrict household to buy annuity after age 88 because in most states there are some restrictions on insurance company that do not allow to sell annuities to very old individuals. Also, the annuities have 10% administrative load on them. So basically, the insurance company, when it issues you annuity, it adds to its price 10%. And this number comes from the paper of Mitchell, Poteva, and Warshawski that show that that corresponds to the numbers in US insurance industry. Finally, for the initial wealth that households start retirement with and the existing annuity holding, I mean Social Security and Defined Benefit Plan annuity, these numbers are calibrated from a head data set. So now I'm going to show you my results. There will be a lot of tables, and this is a roadmap how I'm going to show you the results. I will start with a very simple model that doesn't have any impediments to annuitization. I will add Social Security and defined benefit plan to it. Then I will add medical expenditures. Then I will use the model with Social Security and defined benefit plan and with medical expenditures as a baseline. And to this baseline, one at a time, I will add the following features: adverse selection, bequest, minimum consumption floor, illiquidity of housing wealth, and minimum purchase requirement. Okay, so this is the very first result. So this is the model that doesn't have any impediments to annuitization. You can think about it as a standard life cycle model. And this table shows you the percent of people in each income quintile and overall who buy private annuities at the very first age of retirement. So here again, there is no adverse selection, no bequest motive, no medical expense uncertainty, pretty much the risk consumption minimum floor, but it's very low. So what you can see here is pretty much everyone buys annuity. There is a few people in the bottom income quintiles who do not buy annuity. But these are people who literally start retirement with almost zero wealth. So they pretty much rely on government consumption floor, and they don't have actually money to buy any annuities. But this is basically a full-scale illustration of the puzzle. That's what the model predicts. We have 100%, and the data we have more than 10 times lower. Now let's see what happens if we add Social Security and defined benefit plan to this model. So basically, here, I assume that people start retirement. So basically what I did is, in the data, of course, people, all people start retirement with some amount of Social Security and defined benefit plan. So to construct this experiment, what I did, I just assumed that people sell the annuities from Social Security and defined benefit plan and add the proceeds to the liquid wealth. So basically, the total amount of wealth here is the same. It's just it all comes in non-annuitized form. So let's put Social Security and defined benefit plan back. What you can see is a quite significant decrease in annuity market participation rate. It goes down from 91 to 75%, which is a noticeable decrease. And you can see that pretty much every quintile gets affected. However, even though we have Social Security and defined benefit plan, you can see that the numbers are very high, 10 times higher than in the data. So Social Security is important, but it's obviously not the end of the story. So next, I will add medical expenditures to the model, and I want just you to concentrate on the very first column and the very last column. So what you could notice if you compare these two numbers, you can see that when I add certain medical expenditures to the model, the annuity market participation rate actually increased. And the reason that is happening because the medical expenditures, if you really look at the data, are very steeply increasing with age. So maybe people who just retire don't have on average such a high medical expenditures. But people who end up surviving until very advanced age, most likely they will face very high medical expenditures. So this way, people basically use annuities to build up some income to finance their medical expenditures. So annuities not only used to finance late in life consumption, but also to finance late in life medical expenditures. So the longevity risk and medical expense risk insurance become complements as opposed to substitutes. So the bottom line here, medical expense cannot really help much to explain the puzzle. So now I'm using this model with uncertain medical expenditures and with Social Security and defined benefit plan as a baseline. And now I will add different features to this baseline model. So I will start with adding adverse selection. So previously there is no adverse selection. Everyone gets priced based on his own survival probability. Now there is only one price for everyone at the same age. And of course, people who have low survival probability will face worse prices now, and people with a high survival probability will face lower prices. And to give you some ideas of how different the prices will be in this pooling equilibrium as opposed to individually priced annuities, I put this table here. So if you look at this guy, the guy in a lowest income quintile and in a worst health, in a bad health, this is the guy with the lowest survival probability in this whole crowd. So this guy in equilibrium, in a pooling equilibrium, he faced price that is 73% higher than what he would face if he got priced based on his own survival probability. On the other end, if you take the guy in a good health and in the highest quintile, he will face price that is 13% lower than the price he would face if he got individually priced annuities. So given that, I think you will not be surprised to see the following table. And this table shows you that what happened to annuity market participation rate. For the people in lower quintiles, the annuity market participation rate decreased because they face worse prices now. But for people in a high income quintile, the annuity market participation rate actually increased, because of a better price. Because of that, the overall effect of adverse selection is not really big. It's only around 4%. So next, I will add bequest to the model. So basically, the bequest, recall, is a luxury good in this model. And I borrow the bequest of this form from the paper of Dinaggio, French, and Jones, who show that this particular bequest motif is consistent with household asset decumulation profile observed in a HEAD data set. So what does bequest motif basically mean? The fee is very high, it's 27,000, and it means that if you construct a simple two-period model, you can derive by hand that only people with wealth above 38,000 will leave any bequest. However, once people start caring about bequest, their bequest motive is very strong. Given this, again, you will not be surprised to see that no one actually got affected by this bequest motive except people in the highest income quintile. These are the people for whom bequest motive become operational. And so for them, they decrease the annuity market participation rate. But for other people, there is not much going on, actually. So because of this, the overall annuity market participation rate doesn't really decrease so much. So if you take a stand bequest as a luxury good, not much that it can help you in terms of explaining the puzzle. Next, I will add consumption minimum floor. So remember, in a baseline model, consumption minimum floor is very low. It's around $2,500. Now I raise it to $6,000. You can see that there is a striking effect on the annuity market participation rate. It decreased 20% from 76 to 53. And the most action, what's going on, is observed among people in the low and middle income quintiles. For people in the higher quintiles, there's actually not much going on. So the poorest people are the ones who use consumption minimum floor as a substitute for the private longevity insurance. So next, I will add the minimum purchase requirement. So in all the previous experiments that you just saw, people can buy $1 worth of annuity if they reach to. Now, I assume that if you want to buy annuity, you have to buy annuity that will bring you at least $2,500 per year. And this, given the prices produced by the model, this is correspond to around $25,000 upfront investment. Once we do that, you can see that there is again very noticeable decrease in annuity market participation rate. And if we do not allow people to use their housing wealth, this effect becomes even bigger. So you can see that annuity market participation rate decreased 3 times, which means that in general people are willing to buy annuities, but the amount of money they actually can spare on annuities is not so big. Once you don't let them use housing wealth, and once you put some restriction on how much you have to invest, lots of people drop out. So just as a final experiment, I will show you what happens if we combine all the impediments to amortization that I just talked about. So adverse selection, bequest model, consumption flow, basically everything. And I call this full version of the model. And if you compare it to the baseline, so you can see a quite noticeable decrease. So basically, this model goes a long way toward decreasing annuity market participation rate. But if you compare it to the data, you see still that there is still a room to go. So just to conclude, I consider 7 factors that may contribute to the annuity puzzle, and I identified 4 of them that are important, and they are pre-annuitized wealth, Social Security defined benefit plan, consumption floor, and also minimum purchase requirement, especially when combined with the liquidity of housing wealth. Thank you very much.
Okay. So the discussion for the paper is Professor Tom Davidoff. Professor Davidoff is the founder of business at the University of British Columbia, and he received a PhD in economics from MIT. His research areas include in taxation, reverse mortgage, housing supply, and house price volatility.
Thank you very much, and thanks, Svetlana, for such a clear presentation of what I thought was a very good and important and interesting paper. Recognitions of that, it's a pleasure to be here with Menachem Yari, who I cite so frequently and gave a great presentation earlier. Thanks very much, Moshe, from whom I've learned a lot about annuities and the importance of real options, which I'll turn to in a second. James, I totally agree. I just want to mention one point about my paper on annuities. And this is a tribute to recent novelist Peter Diamond. My original title was Annuities and Welfare, and he insisted that we change it to Annuities and Individual Welfare, because he's a smart cookie and recognized that you know, we didn't know what the effect was on welfare, and we've learned it's quite plausibly a negative effect on total welfare. Okay, so what I thought I'd do is I would start off with what I thought I knew about annuities based on other people's work and my own, and then think about what's in a Venn diagram, something like that, what I actually learned from this paper, and then maybe what I don't totally agree with on the paper based on what I think, and some, you know, possible directions for future research. Okay, so the baseline is that retirement should be financed by annuities. You can leave a bequest, fine, but anything you want to consume should be financed out of annuities. And it's probably in the original paper if you look carefully, but what our contribution was, one of them was the way you can evaluate the gain to annuities is think about an equivalent variation. So it's the consumption that your compensated consumption from retirement to death multiplied by the change in prices that are induced by annuitizing your wealth rather than not. And the changes in price of consumption are much greater late in life, because starting at age 62, you're not very likely to die at age 63, so annuities don't cheapen your consumption at age 63 much at all. So if you want to consume everything between 62 and 63, annuities aren't great. On the other hand, if you're willing to be patient and backload your consumption to age 95, then annuities are fabulous. And I sort of like to think that most, when you sort of add and subtract from demand for annuities, it's all about, are you okay with backloading when your assets pay out, or do you need your assets to be front-loaded or liquid? Okay, so why don't we see much annuitization? Okay, so incomplete annuity markets aren't a good rationalization, and they're not a good rationalization for a couple of reasons. One is, if you want to explain no demand for annuities at all, that's hard, because people will always have demand for any annuity you can possibly design. No matter how badly designed it is, there should be some positive demand for it, as long as it cheapens consumption in some state of the world, as long as there's demand for positive consumption in every state. So I think that's the role of the consumption floor in this paper, is once you've got Social Security providing a background, that role, that result is actually out the window. But the other important result was brought up by James, and I think is a good one, which is, you know, if annuities don't provide desired consumption streams, then why don't you build an annuitized version of the assets that you like? So many papers say, well, annuities aren't so good because they force you to go in bonds instead of the stock market, but there are variable annuities, and if there weren't, there should be. Okay. So stochastic uninsurable medical expenses, we know, lead to ambiguous results. Why? Well, there's more demand for precautionary savings, and medical expenses tend to come late in life. So that makes me want to have more wealth later when these medical expenses are going to arise. I want to save more, so there's more value to annuitization. On the other hand, I may not be satisfied with a late stream of consumption because medical expenses introduce a liquidity problem. As we talked about earlier, it's hard to make a reversible annuity because that winds up being a transfer from people who get hit by a bus to people who die of cancer, which is okay, but not a great product. So if I worry about a need for long-term care, that's probably going to happen when I'm 90, but might happen when I'm 72, then I really need to carry a lot of liquid wealth even when I'm age 72, and so an annuity that forces me to sip consumption when I might need a gulp is going to be no good. So it's ambiguous theoretically what happens, and I had always thought that all the calibrations I had done and seen said that the dominant effect is actually the illiquidity problem. And so a constant real annuity is going to be less attractive, and annuities in general will be less attractive. Okay, illiquid home equity, which was introduced, the issue here is, it's sort of a straightforward issue in this paper, which is it doesn't count as wealth. A more nuanced view would be that when you have home equity, there's actually two effects, and it interacts with medical. So first of all, people do sell their houses. Around age 92, 93, you start to see people move from home ownership to home rentership. And home equity then is paying out late in life. But if you have home equity paying out late in life, that makes annuities less attractive because annuities, again, are valuable exactly because they provide consumption very late in life. But that's when you're moving from liquidity constrained to cash rich. So that covariance is really unfortunate. So even a more robust design, and this is my paper, Housing, Health, and Annuities in the Journal of Risk and Insurance. You know, even if you enriched housing, you'd get basically the same result. But you get an intriguing result, which is the interaction between medical expense and annuities gets more nuanced, because home equity is triggered by two things: very advanced age where you just can't stay in the house, but also the need for long-term care, at least in the U.S. In Canada, I think it's a little bit less so because of the tax treatment and public benefits treatment of home expense for long-term care versus facility expense. But home equity basically is going to cover stochastic medical expenses. I think one reason we don't see a reverse mortgage market is because people think of housing as a buffer stock. And so if you have home equity, the effect of medical uncertainty, you're basically going to get rid of the negative liquidity problem, and then bundling something like long-term care with annuities may actually be a bad idea, because now you have three assets, long-term care insurance, a house, and an annuity that all pay off late in life. Okay. And then bequests plus adverse selection are another major reason why you might have a small market. So with the bequest motive, this is in the original paper, you might reduce your demand for annuities, but you'll still finance all your consumption with annuities. However, once annuities become less than actuarially fair, there's no result of even positive annuitization. Zero annuitization would be optimal if I have a bequest motive and annuities are not as good as conventional assets, unless they're actuarially balanced. Okay. Now, you'll have reduced demand, and what's going to be the effect in adverse selection? Well, this is really interestingly played out in the paper. The adverse selection is particularly bad for the unhealthy, who tend to be poor, but it's going to be on the bequest side, of course, you're going to think demand for bequests is a superior good. Okay. So what did I learn from this paper? First of all, what I thought was really impressive was I've always written off the possibility of solving an adverse selection model. And Svetlana didn't really sell it here, but she actually sells for what the prices of annuities will be based on who decides to annuitize. And healthier people who tend to be more affluent are going to be those who buy more annuities. And so you get adverse selection. And I think that was really nicely done. And she actually has a model where the prices reflect selection. And the something that, I am conjecturing somebody else mentioned earlier is, there can be, I guess that was your discussion, was that there can be winners in adverse selection, right? I mean, depending on the distribution of health, there can be a sizable chunk of the population that actually gets more favorable pricing. And so since the wealthier those who are predisposed to buy annuities in the first place, you can actually get, for some people, an increase in annuitization. And this model confirms that, and I think that's really nice. Okay, next, and I want to beat up on this point a little bit. There's no red. Stochastic medical expenses can actually increase demand for annuities. Again, it's theoretically possible, but I had thought calibrations always showed the opposite effect, and so I thought that was intriguing. Next, the minimum purchase can have significant effects. Okay, so, just something I never considered, but it really plays an important role in this paper. And of course, that's going to now have an interesting interaction with selection, because it's the poor who can't afford the minimum floor, so adverse selection sort of gets worse. The pool of mortality gets worse, and pricing is going to get worse, which is going to make annuities a catastrophe for low-income people. Now, so that's interesting. And then bequest is a superior good. Maybe there aren't such big effects. I want to turn to that in a second. Okay. So the model of adverse selection. The one thing I would really say would make add realism and make the paper most of the effects stronger is you mention cost of an annuity, which I think you call a 10% administrative load. Okay, so I don't buy a 10% administrative cost because that's a lot of administration. And I certainly don't believe it's variable, right? I mean, the big issue with an annuity versus a conventional asset would be I have to check that you die. But even if you buy a teeny tiny annuity, I still have to check that you're dead and continue to write you checks. So if I think about this as a fixed cost, that would be the reason you would have a minimum purchase, okay? And we saw earlier in Su Feng's paper that, a fixed cost can actually have a very different effect on who buys annuity than a percentage cost. And I can't see that the variable cost would be nearly as big as the fixed cost of having one of these. Okay, and that would rationalize the minimum purchase. So just endogenize the administrative load, and I think that would really strengthen everything. Okay, drop the requirement, if any, of a constant payout. So that would make adverse selection torture. But with your medical expenses, there may be a desire for a upward-sloping annuity payout. So you have the possibility of repurchase of annuities later, and that's the reason that's optimal is because you want an upward-sloping trajectory. But the optimal trajectory being upward-sloping is fine. You can just have an upward-sloping trajectory to begin with. There's no reason the payout needs to be constant. So I would drop the requirement of constant payout somehow, the problem being feasibility. Shashinsky has, I think, a two-period model in continuous time or even many periods would be extremely hard to solve, adverse selection where you get to choose the trajectory of payout. Shashinsky's interesting result is that you can get these minimum guaranteed payouts for 10 years or something as a means of signaling, even though they're welfare destructive. Okay, housing. So Ardal and Varaya, in an important response to Yari, say that we can't ignore housing. And the big issue is the key to the value of annuities is the demand for savings. What Ardal and Varaya say is suppose you have a house and you don't want to move out of the house. They have it costly for economic reasons. I think it's mostly costly for utility reasons. This is very painful for older people to leave their home. It's painful for anybody to leave their home. Okay. So suppose you don't want to leave the house, but eventually you do leave the house. Well, why are you leaving the house? You're leaving the house because the house has worth present value of all rents forever, whereas you're only consuming present value of rents while you're alive. So you're only going to sell the house to tap that extra savings, which is for liquidity reasons. So the date at which you do this unpleasant act must be a date at which you've run your savings to zero, because if it's inefficient to sell, the only reason to sell would be because you've hit the liquidity constraint. Okay, so it's hugely important to introduce housing, and I think given the dominant role of housing in retiree portfolios, I would encourage all of us who think about retirement funds to make sure we've actually got a reasonable endogenous model of housing. Of course, it's very difficult to do. Okay, so in this paper, it is included, which I think is great, but it, you know, you can just enrich it a little bit. So the it's either non-wealth, illiquid, or perfectly liquid. And of course, this is going to have a bigger effect at the bottom. I wanted to be a little careful. I think you're right. I think it's true that there's basically nobody in the United States who has meaningful assets above some consumption floor that would actually buy annuities and is a renter. But, you know, at the bottom of the income distribution, it's true that conditional on having a house, housing is a bigger fraction of your wealth because housing has an income elasticity less than one. But if there's renters at the bottom, of course, some of them might be, you know, the effect on annuitization wouldn't be anything. Okay. So it's the desire to not sell the home that matters. I think you can endogenize this into a life cycle model. I mean, you're doing everything numerically. You have to. And, you know, you can just have a disutility of sale. You don't like selling your house, but you get the liquidity when you sell. And you could do it that way. The other thing I did in my paper on long-term care is to introduce housing as a buffer stock for medical expense. And there what I had is it's such a great disutility to sell your house that you never do it, except that the disutility goes away if you have a significant enough medical shock. So you could have housing as a buffer stock a little bit more realistic. I don't think it would importantly change the results, but you know, quantitatively, but a more realistic model is always better. So housing, you want to think of as pre-insurance for medical catastrophe, and also pre-insurance of extreme longevity. Okay, so probably would soften the effect, because here housing just disappears. You subtract it from wealth. I think it is important we subtract it, but not quite entirely. Okay, now, here's an important question. Could your model deliver no reverse mortgage demand? Because an extension of the no annuities puzzle is the no reverse mortgage puzzle. I consider the no reverse mortgage puzzle to be stronger because like an annuity, a reverse mortgage takes money from when you're dead and gives it to you when you're alive. So that embeds the annuity puzzle. But it's worse because while reverse mortgages are like annuities, they enhance rather than subtract from liquidity, right? They make you liquid in the period before you've sold your house. And generally, you're getting a lump sum or a line of credit that you get to spend whenever you want. You could buy an annuity with a reverse mortgage, but people generally don't. They're taking it as cash. So, you know, I don't know that any of the explanations you have would be enough to get rid of, other than bequest. I don't think there's any explanation for the reverse mortgage puzzle. Okay. Bequest and the highest income. Okay, so I don't believe anybody with serious wealth should buy an annuity because I'm going to disagree with you, Larry Kotlikoff. I don't think rich people, if you tell them, you know, how much do I have to give you today in case you die tomorrow? And I think the answer would be a lot, you know, dollar for dollar. I think the answer is for me to get a dollar your wealth when you're dead tomorrow, I think they'd charge me closer to a dollar than zero, right? So, so I guess what I'd say is I probably believe a functional form that would be linear in bequest. so that you wouldn't buy any bequest up to a certain wealth like you have, but then everything would go to bequest after that, and that would soften the extent of annuitization among the wealthy. So, you know, is there an upper bound on wealth that annuitizes? You know, Bill Gates isn't going to buy annuities because all the money's going to Africa, and so he would have zero demand for annuities. So there's a modest effect on participation of introducing the bequest. So one question would be, if you made it more superior, could you get more mileage out of the bequest? One point would be, you have some measures of how much annuity you buy conditional on purchasing the annuity. Generally, I think I prefer how many dollars go into annuities than how many people buy them. And of course, the other question is, what's the equivalent or compensating variation of introducing annuities? And there, the bequest effect might have a stronger effect on your results if you present them in that way. Okay. But it looks like small purchases all around. So the role of purchase, when you add the minimum purchase requirement, the reason the minimum purchase requirement is having a bite, it's having a bite all through the income distribution, which suggests there's actually, you are managing to get very weak demand throughout the income distribution. Okay. Medical expense. I should go quickly. So if medical expense were a big deal, this is something you can just, you find medical expenses not what you do, and you don't find medical expenses a big deal. But if medical expense is a big deal, then that would explain why there's so great annuitization in the EU and Canada, where there's much more comprehensive medical insurance. But that's not a true fact, so that suggests medical probably can't be driving differences in annuity demand across countries, because there is a big difference in annuity demand across countries, but there's a big difference in insurance and provision and medical expense across countries. Okay, so why are we getting different results in the medical simulations than those that I've seen? Okay, you're getting two points. One, you're getting more participation with stochastic medical expenses, but I don't know that you're getting more actually dollars invested. I think you do get more dollars for the wealthy, but for others you're getting less dollars. So again, the measure of what we mean by annuitization is important. I'm guessing you're getting less negative effect of stochastic medical expenses in terms of the liquidity for a couple of reasons. One, you may be including stuff other than long-term care. I think some papers are sort of sloppy with their treatment of medical expense because we're only including long-term care. I think we're all sloppy in the sense that there's a lot of liquidity invents in old age. Your kid goes to jail, your daughter gets divorced, you can go on a big vacation with your friends. We've only introduced one, really, which is long-term care. You're introducing more, which I think is better. And I suppose what's really going on here is you're increasing the marginal utility of wealth while alive to marginal utility when dead for the wealthy because of these medical shocks. And that's the quest. And I don't know that anybody else has bundled the quest plus medical expense. Okay. Now, can you explain? So would there not be demand in your model for bundled medical plus annuity? Other than housing, I haven't seen a convincing explanation for why you don't see this market. So there's the annuity puzzle, there's the reverse mortgage puzzle, but then the other big puzzle is nobody in the U.S. buys long-term care insurance, okay? And if we're so worried about these large medical expenses, why aren't people insuring them? And even more, why aren't they bundled with annuity? Because if you skip my housing story, not only is there this great bundling on the demand side that you get rid of the liquidity problem of annuities when you bundle it with long-term care insurance, but it's great on the supply side too, because the need for long-term care is negatively correlated with living a long time. So the two effects cancel out, and that should be the world's greatest product. So it'd be great to see if your model can actually generate reduced demand even for this product. Okay, and then just a technical question. Do you get to keep the lower bound on consumption after your medical expense? Medicaid pays for your big medical disaster, but once you're out of the hospital, it's not giving you anything. Or is that just SSI, or just the minimum consumption floor that everybody gets? I wasn't quite sure what the minimum floor was doing. Okay, so summarizing. I thought this was a really carefully executed paper. The parameterization was very good. There's new interesting results that I hadn't seen before, and I would just encourage here, or possibly in subsequent work, because there's already a lot going on, push on endogenizing housing liquidity, think about really pushing on bequest for the wealthy, allow a flexible payout trajectory, and see if your results are consistent not only with weak demand for annuity, but other missing bundles of annuities and other stuff that we don't see in the market.